Come along and join Associate Producer Laura Kaler reporting from Columbus, Ohio at the Hilton Columbus Downtown.
This is Laura Kaler, Associate Producer for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer. Today we talk with Chef Bill Glover of Columbus, Ohio, who is helping pull the community together around a regional food system. Chef Glover is encouraging other local chefs to be more creative in their menus in order to make use of what local farmers can provide rather than trying to build their menus first and source the food around it. With the development of an online tool that will bring farmers, chefs, and consumers together, as well as creating a great example in his own menu at Gallery Bar and Bistro inside the Hilton Columbus downtown, Chef Glover is helping tell the story of the Columbus food scene. I'm in Columbus, Ohio with Executive Chef Bill Glover of Gallery Bar and Bistro, the Hilton Columbus downtown. Thanks for having us, Bill.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Yeah. We'll start with a little bit about you. We're going to get to the farm to table, the event yesterday and everything, but are you originally from Columbus?
Born in Western Pennsylvania, Newcastle. It's about 40 minutes north of Pittsburgh. When I was in fourth grade in the mid-80s, we moved to Ohio, grew up in North Canton, Ohio. My dad was transferred with his company, and that's kind of what brought us a state over to the west. Went through grade school, high school there. At 18 years old, I rented a U-Haul with one of my buddies who was an Ohio State student, and came down here to learn more about more opportunities for cooking, learning, and I always say that I went to Ohio State socially, not for the academic side, but where I grew up in North Canton, great small town environment, you know, good people, good foundation built there. But I just like knew at an early age I wanted to cook, and coming here provided more opportunities. And I found a job when I first got down here at a country club, which was really a good opportunity because it gave, like, when you're feeding the same membership, you have to change food a lot. You're constantly changing menus and learning new things and finding new products to work with. So it was kind of an accelerated learning curve. And, you know, I worked at a different club after that. Then I got into some independent restaurants. Then I actually went and worked at Ohio State. There's a private club on campus called the Faculty Club. It's been there since 1946. That was where I got my first executive chef role. I was there 6 years. I left there in 2008 to open my own restaurant named Sage American Bistro, named after my oldest daughter, my only daughter. I have a son too, but her name. We had that 6 years. And that's where our GM found me. We were a perennial top 10 list, and when he moved here from Boston, he got that magazine and he went to all those 10 restaurants because in his mind he had an idea of what he wanted to do here at the hotel restaurant. And kind of changing that stigma of what that might be. Here in America, that doesn't always mean people think that's where I want to go. And you go to Europe and that's often where some of the best restaurants are, but here it's kind of drifted more towards the independent sector of the business. Mm-hmm. And he came here from the Boston area, so he had a really good food background growing up, and he's been in the hotel business for 20 years. Has worked at some phenomenal properties that had, some of which had, like, you know, licensing agreements with chefs that many have heard of in bigger markets. And he wanted to take that blueprint and do it here in Columbus and find somebody that had a strong local reputation in the independent world that could come into this restaurant and do something that was different. With the backing of the Hilton corporate folks that said, you know, I think you're crazy, but if you think it can work, go find it and try it. And he wound up sitting at our bar one night at Sage, and I was sitting there, and I'm exchanging pleasantries with this guy, like, oh, have you ever had this? This is good, you know? And I'm like, well, I should just say hello, I'm Bill, and this is my place. And he's like, oh, great. And he told me where he was from and what he was about. He was the GM at the New Hilton downtown. And I just offhandedly just said, oh, cool, who's your chef? And he said, I don't know yet. Do you have any ideas? And we began a dialogue at that point. And giving it some thought for a week, I discussed it with my staff at my restaurant and thought, you know, this might be a job that could not only help my own career grow, but it could also drive publicity and business to the restaurant. I could do both, so I felt it was important they didn't find out that I was considering an option.
Right.
I felt like they needed to buy into it. Because of the strength of that team doing well, I could feasibly do both, which is what I did for a full year. So I took the job after 8 weeks of interviewing. We brought the same philosophy and the reputation that I built at Sage into this restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the same practices with sourcing and food style. And
so talk about that a little bit.
A lot of Hiltons, like, they give you what they call a core menu. So for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they say, here's your menu, here's your products. And here, they wanted to try something new. And in the entire country, this was the only one of its kind at the time, like, that they said to a chef, here you go, do your thing. So that was very attractive to me because it allowed me to adhere to my philosophies on how to look at cooking and how to look at cooking for the audience of this part of the country using ingredients from the central Ohio area. I could play that into the menu. It worked well. So, you know, we open, things are great, critics, you know, very favorable reviews. And then, much like myself, I had this opportunity, and so did a lot of my core people at my restaurant. So they got an opportunity to go up to Cleveland to work for Jonathan Sawyer, who recently won the Great Lakes James Beard Award last year. So it was kind of like, okay, you know, I get it. I can't just go out and hire what you guys know. So, and honestly, it was a lot to do both, to try to run this giant building as a first-time ever hotel guy. You know, so that kind of ran its course.
Mm-hmm. So with Sage, you closed
it? I sold
it
to a couple local independent chefs,
okay.
And they kind of carried on with their similar philosophy and approach, but in their own way, you know. So it's still there, it's a restaurant, it's like good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we carried on with this thing and what we're doing here, and we build a team, we do banquets, we do what we do here in the restaurant, and like a lot of what we've carried over from our approach there is the relationships that we build with local farms and farmers, going out into the community, meeting people at farmers markets, and then understanding their ability to meet our needs from a supply demand, you know. And I think sometimes I hear chefs talk about how that is a hurdle, but you can jump over a hurdle, you know. That's not a roadblock, that's not a dead end. And I think that that's something that I've personally challenged some of my local colleagues. Like, don't think that just because it doesn't come from Sysco, you can't get it. Like,
right.
Go find a way to get it.
What made you want to do it this way?
I just feel like it's a responsibility to the craft. It's an obligation to make sure that I'm helping support the small town farms, the smaller communities that are outside of our city area. But, you know, even with that said, there's some urban farming going on here that's outstanding.
Hmm.
I live in a neighborhood called Clintonville, which is just north of where we are sitting right now, about 7 miles. And it's full of artists, musicians, just people that are into cultural arts and whatnot. And there's some folks that have done some really cool stuff, urban farms in their backyard that can meet our needs sometimes. I was, last fall, I was invited to cook in New York at the James Beard House, and I went there with this idea of doing a 100% Ohio source menu, and I had ginger on there, and I'm like, oh shit, where am I going to find ginger? And I found it. There's a small farm in Clintonville called Swainway Farms, and they're growing this young ginger, and it worked out, you know, so I didn't have to really alter my menu. I was able to do no ocean fish. Obviously, there's no ocean fish here,
right.
But there's a trout farm that's spring-fed in Urbana, which is about 45 minutes west of here, and I went and got the fish. I did a fish course. And
mm-hmm.
I was able to do a well-rounded, complete menu
mm-hmm.
that was, even lemons. I found a greenhouse in Toledo that has, like, the full, like, adult lemon tree.
Nice.
Like, I only need, like, six.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So you were the first chef from Columbus to have any, I mean, you went and cooked there, and then you can also receive an award, but no one from Columbus had done anything with James Beard.
About 20 years ago, there was a chef that was nominated in the semifinalists. His name was Kent Rigsby. He had a restaurant right here in the Short North for about 20 years. I was fortunate to be the first chef invited to New York from Columbus to cook at the house.
And so has the fame that has come from that, has that helped you sway other chefs to look at doing things with the same philosophy that you have?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely that mentality exists with a number of chefs in the city. But what I think it's done is it's kind of solidified my role that I embrace as a leading voice and really pounding the drum on this stuff. Like, a lot of people talk about using local, and it's overused, the word. It becomes watered down when, and like yesterday at the event we did where we had the town hall meeting with farmers and chefs and industry folks, and one of the farmers that I invited to be on the panel was like, I've literally seen my name on a menu and I haven't sold this restaurant anything in a year. And that's a problem, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's the truth in menus, like it's integrity-based business. And you have to, if you're a diner, you come and you trust that what's on here is going to be served you wholesome and cared for and properly prepared. And when you start to look at menus and you see things as a farmer that you know that your product's not in that room, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of like challenge the chefs. Like, we buy beef from a small farm in Athens called RL Valley Ranch, and it's incredible. It's fourth generation. It's like a 200 head cattle ranch on like 450 acres, and he's doing things the old way, like 50, 60 years ago, the way beef was. And it was 18 to 24 months, slowly grown, pasture raised, eating grass. And it does get some grain at the end, but he plants, harvests, and grows the corn that he knows is non-GMO. He handles it himself. He runs the combine. He plants it and he harvests it in the fall every year. And then he like has the storage capacity to make sure that he knows where it is and the way it's stored and the humidity and the temperature and all that stuff. And then he gets a great deal of what's mixed into that corn is spent barley from a brewery that's also in Athens called Jackie O's, which is a phenomenal brewery. It's ranked in the top 50 breweries in the world for the last 5 years. So like,
so he knows every step of the way.
Every single step.
Yeah, and it's all local.
He does the whole thing. I mean, he has a wife and two young daughters and a few dogs running around, but like, he jumps on the horse. He does what he needs to do to corral the cattle, to do, you know, to do the whole process. So it's not too big where it can get away from him or something that might slip through the process. It's like he handles it 7 days a week, every day of the year. And when you can find something like that, you really understand that when you go to his farm and you can walk up to the cattle and they're not like skittish or running away, they're not all amped up and tense. It matters in what ends up on the plate. I have a similar relationship with a hog farmer that's in Granville, which is like 35 minutes from here. He's growing 11 heritage breed hogs on pasture. You know, the same way, slow growth. He lets them finish. He doesn't push them. He doesn't feed them anything abnormal to what a normal diet would be. He feeds them on a regimented schedule with all whole grains, and that kind of thing matters, you know, and especially in the pork world where everything's just being geared towards lean, and like the grocery store commodity pork just is not what it's just been bred to be lean, and that's.
But now with that process, they can't produce as much, correct?
True.
So chefs can't get as many cuts of something that they might want.
True, and that's something that does come up, and it's funny, Brandon, because I called him this summer at one point, because we buy half hogs from him. We were able to be creative with how we use the animal, but we make a ham for our lunch menu out of the hams, because it's a tough cut to like, you can't like cut a steak and be like, here you go. I had a run on this item, and I called him, I'm like, can I get a couple hams? He's like, Bill, I don't grow hams.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, man, we'll just send me what you need to do, you know, and we'll make it work. And it's the same way with our beef. Like, you'll see on our dinner menu, it says RL Valley Beef. We don't list a steak. We list the farm and the animal that which it comes from. And what it does is it gives that server an opportunity to come to a table and tell the story, which is what it's all about. So we're saying tonight's steak is strip, filet, ribeye, you know, sirloin, whatever.
Yeah.
And then it allows us to buy a half side and make it work. So out of like the top round and the bottom round and the flank and all the things that aren't necessarily center of the plate type meats, we grind our trim to make sure we use everything. We use the bones to make stock. Like literally it's 100% usage. But it's a philosophy that it's become normal to us, but there are friends of mine that work in this business that I say, hey man, you got to talk to Rob from Arrow Valley. His beef is phenomenal. Well, if he can't get me 20 tenderloins a weekend, I can't even talk to him. I'm like, well, you're limiting yourself.
Right.
you go to the commodity farms and you can do that, and you can buy from the major broadliners and get exactly what you want, cut into the perfect rectangle, and it comes vacuum sealed per steak. And that's where food has gone. But it takes away what it is to be a chef and to how to really get creative.
And I liked that you said the menu and the server can tell a story, because
exactly.
It is about education for the consumer too. And I think that the event that you had yesterday, which I would love to talk
sure.
about, that was educational for everybody that was there. So
that's right.
Who all was there?
So over the summer, I worked with Edible Columbus. Now, there's edibles in many markets all over the country. The edible brand is often focused on farming and food. And
yeah, I've read some of their magazines around the country.
Yeah. So we have an awesome branch or whatever here in Columbus. And Trisha Wheeler is the publisher, producer, the president, or I'm not sure exact title, but her and I have touched paths over the years, and I invited her to an event we did this summer, and we just got to talking about sourcing, and I kind of touched on some of the things I've mentioned here. Like, I was with my hog farmer one day, and a chef friend of mine was at this event. I'm like, hey, you should check out his pork. Well, like, it's not consistent. And I was like, dude, you can't look at it like tenderloin only. That's not sustainable. You have to look at broader pictures. Same thing I hear from the farmers, though. Like, that's my same... James Anderson's Anderson Farms pork. And one time he sent me half a hog in it. He called me and he's like, hey, man, can you weigh that? I need to know how much to charge you. I'm like, you gotta be shitting me. Like, what? He's like, I don't know. I sent it to the processor. I need you to weigh it. I'm like, James, that thing's in like the hams are in brine. Some of it's ground.
Right.
Like, I don't.
We can't put it back together.
Buddy, I don't know. So, you know, but I hear things like that. The same thing with my beef farmer. He sent me a half side one week. I realized, like, over the weekend, I never got the invoice. And then our accounting department's like, hey, you need an invoice with delivery, you know, stuffy accountants. I'm like, it'll be fine. He'll get it to us.
Right.
And they're like, no, it's not policy. And they're rigid. You know, like, I'm a chef, and I think creatively, and they think numbers in black and white. You know, I called Rob. I'm like, hey, man, I need that invoice. He's like, sorry, man. I had two calves come, and I had a horse get out. Like, my wife's pregnant. Like, he has real-life things that are challenges for him. And I'm like, look, I get it. I just want to pay you. Like,
right.
I can guarantee you can get paid from me, you know. And that's – all these things started to kind of add up in my head. Like, I'm hearing things from, like, my colleagues, from farmers – from consumers that want to know, where can I go buy this? And it all kind of started to kind of create this idea. And that's what Trisha from Edible and I started to talk about. Can we develop something that's like an online tool? Like, in her mind, and that's my lead to her. And she's like, I've had this like Craigslist of food in my head for like a number of years. And I've been looking for somebody in the chef world to really lead it and to be the voice and to be really carrying the torch on your side, because I believe that it will work. And that's when we began to start talking about this idea, looking at what can we do, what can we create that is a tool that you can log in as either a chef, a farmer, a consumer, a job board, like a farmhand ad, like farmhand needed, like all these different things that help the food systems be the strongest they can be. Like, if I grow lettuce and I know I can plant 10 rows but only plant 4 because I'm worried I won't sell 10, mm-hmm. that inhibits ingredient availability.
Right. Yeah, and you don't want the farmers to be wasting their time and
true.
Not
and,
making
you know,
money.
There's a lot of labor going into these things for them,
yeah.
And a seed is basically, there's money there that is potential.
Right.
But if they plant it, then it's, you know, it's got an end date.
Exactly. It only stays fresh so long.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where it all kind of stemmed from. And, you know, you put all these things together and you hear different things from different role players in the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we wound up. And it was like, let's get together and have a town hall meeting. So yesterday, we kind of brought this whole thing together where we started working on this food systems website and how we can build this tool. So what we wanted to do is get it almost ready or get it as close as we could and then show it to everybody. We set up like a generic email for everybody to like email like ideas, thoughts about the tool, about the day, what they thought, like We sold 60 tickets within a number of 10 days, and Trisha got 30 people asking, can I come? And I got the same. So it's there's a lot of momentum beyond who was able to get in yesterday. It also started this idea, maybe we need to do this quarterly or continue this idea where these conversations can continue.
And so with the online tool, is that a social media type tool?
It's a .com. Not that Facebook isn't or whatever, but it does have a social aspect to it, because it's you can go on and create a profile and basically represent yourself as a member of the community in different disciplines that have to do with...
So chef, farmer, consumer.
Yep.
Okay, cool.
The consumer side, I think that there's opportunity there. It's more geared towards the chefs and the farmers. The connectivity to create better communication, so we know what's out there, what's available, and to help build the bridges between relationships.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time where I didn't know where to go find good lamb, but I do now because of my own work. But let's make it easier. I'm fortunate because of the role I have here. I have 32 cooks. I have a chef that on a day-to-day basis runs the restaurant, who I've worked with on and off for 16 years, so that's an incredible relationship. You just can't go higher. I have a banquet chef that handles the catering side of what we do, and it gives me a chance to be more administrative, more PR, sourcing. I can wake up and drive to Athens an hour away and spend the day there and call it a day of work. That's outstanding.
Yeah.
A lot of independent chefs don't have that luxury.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very fortunate and grateful for that opportunity, but it's allowed me to really drive and be a conduit for relationship building. I've known James, our pig farmer, for a lot of years. He's a barbecue guy, and he's got an incredible barbecue business. That's where I met him. He parked near my restaurant. He had a food truck. He has some land down in Hocking Hills, and we were there one night around a campfire, and he's like, I want to start raising pigs. Do you think I could? My only concern is being able to get rid of it.
Right.
I'm like, well, I got that. You put 12 good pork chops in a car, and we'll drive to every chef I know, and it'll be over.
Nice.
It's been a long time coming, but it's just kind of developed into this thing where, because of the facility that's here, something I realized very early is that the size of the kitchen, the building, the rooms, when we talk about doing collaborative dinners from a regional perspective, James Beard does a thing called the Celebrity Chef Tour. It's like a traveling arm of the James Beard Foundation, where they go all over the country doing these dinners. So I invited 9 chefs from all over the Great Lakes region this spring to do a dinner. Well, where are you going to stay? Right up here. There's plenty of room in the kitchen, regardless of what's going on our regular business, to be able to do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Inviting chefs locally in to do dinners like that to kind of drive the collaborative spirit. That collaboration goes into the farming as well, from the tables, the chairs, all of it. The soap, they're all local, as much as possible. If you think of things locally, it doesn't end with the food. You have to look at it a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new restaurant that opened last night called Rock Mill Tavern. All the wood in the place is barn wood that's local, and the candles are local.
Cool.
You can take that philosophy much further than just food sourcing.
So do you see yourself as a marketer for the farmers, because they don't have time to always necessarily market their goods?
Yeah, and that's something that came up. I was saying, I met James, and as soon as I met Rob, our beef guy, who came in here one day with a cowboy hat on and a pair of jeans, and our host was like, yeah, there's a cowboy here to see. I'm like, I don't have an appointment. And I came out, I'm like, how you doing? I'm Bill. And he's like, yeah, man, I've heard a lot about you. And I was in town, and I wanted to bring you some of my beef and see what you thought. I was like, okay, let's go back. And I cooked it and tasted it and was blown away. I'm like, let's go. Let's get it going. What do I need to do? And we got our information exchange and, set him up as a vendor. And we just started buying beef from him. But then those two met, and they talked every day for months. And they talk on a regular basis. And it's that connectivity between people. It's no different than, I know folks that are on the PR side, they call me when there's a chef opening, who do you know, who's ready, who's... So it's a really unique thing, and I've been here 22 years, so not many resumes come over my desk of prospective candidates that I can't look down and call somebody to be what do you think, or how'd this person do for you, because a lot of folks want to come here because it's very much a learning kitchen. It's well known, our approach. The things that I've been fortunate enough to be involved in have given us a strong reputation as a place to come and work and learn. So there is a strong feeling and a pride within myself that I have been able to bridge a lot of relationships mm-hmm. with not only myself and what benefits us here, but overall in the entire community. So it's less about me and it's more about making Columbus a very well-recognized place in the heartland of America, and one of the strongest agricultural places in North America is right here in Ohio.
And so it's not just about football here?
Yeah, it's a lot. Well, yeah. That's what a lot of people think. It's just a college town. And the Buckeyes and, you know, what OSU is to this city is major economic impact. I mean, there's...
But it's so much more.
It's so much more. Yeah. I mean, the art community here is outstanding. There's a great music scene. The dining scene's really strong. The university is a big deal, but we've got, you know, we've got quite a few learning institutions here mm-hmm. that aren't Ohio State that are really good records. You know, it's a great place.
Yeah. And so back to the event, what was it called?
It was called the Ohio Food Systems, I think is what we called it. But food systems was the root of it all. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it isn't just about the ingredients. It's not just about the farmers. It's about the I refer to it as a three-legged stool. You have the chef, the farmer, and the consumer. So we can cook with all the passion and care in the world, but if the ingredients aren't strong before we get them, then the consumer's not buying it. It's that cyclical thing that if it's not complete, then it's not working. That was such a special moment to see the community kind of rise up and want to come in here. And we had the panelists of three farmers, three chefs, and two industry kind of go-betweens. One of the women here runs the food service operations at Denison University, which is 40% local, and they have a goal to hit 80. Ohio State's director of food services was here, and he stood up and he was talking about that currently Ohio State, the entire campus is 10%. And they want to get to 40% within the next 8 to 10 years, which he said it's going to take all of that time-wise because of the volume. I mean, there's more students on Ohio State's campus than any in the country. I mean, it's a major, huge school.
It's huge,
So when you talk about meals per day and the logistics of that, like just to think of like even one item to go to like all free-range eggs, you're talking about 60,000 eggs a day.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You have to find the infrastructure mm-hmm. to make that commitment. And the time it takes for not only the delivery, but like to make sure that the farms are at a place where they can sustain that. Any farmer wants to hear that. Sure, that'd be great. Because they can just book it, you know. But they have to be able to meet that demand. And that's a pretty daunting thing sometimes.
Right. So what came out of the event yesterday?
A big thing that I really wanted to get my point across, and I was able to based on the way the dialogue went, was to really challenge chefs to not be lazy, frankly. Just because you can buy a box of New York strips that are exactly the same doesn't mean it's the best product available. Like, buy a side of beef from this guy and cut them. And just be creative with how you present your menu. That doesn't mean all the accompaniments have to change. Just cut your steaks and grind your own burgers. Like, it's no filler, no BS in there. Like, make it the best it can be. And, like, the farmers, you know, the farmers are somewhat solitary in a lot of their lives because they're just, like, on their farm and there's not a lot, they're in the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to sit them in this kind of building in front of 60 people is a very foreign environment for them. And they were somewhat quiet. They spoke with meaningful words, not many words. And at the end, it was kind of like we went down the row and Rob, the beef guy, was like, you know, is there anything that I could do better? And I said, Rob, just keep doing what you're doing. We need to do better. You're kicking ass. Like, we as the media needs to do a better job speaking about what the chefs are doing, what the farms are doing, and to enlighten the consumers to pay a couple bucks more. It's worth every penny.
I'm looking at your menu here, and it's not overly priced. It's very reasonable.
I agree, and I think but you know, you get comparative thinking towards, you look down at this and say, I go to Applebee's and get three courses of swag for $15, but you come here, and you have, you know, a cheese board for the same, but these cheeses are made by small family farms all in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what... I think other parts of the country are better at. What I think it comes down to most, and what I challenged the chefs to do better, but I also challenged the media to be more activated, to bring awareness to what we're doing and why one of the chefs on the panelists stopped himself when he was talking about charging a premium. He used the word premium a couple times in a dialogue, and he stopped. He's like, you know, it's not premium, it's appropriate. It's a better word. And he said it to the group. They got it because many of them are on one or the other side of it, you know?
Right.
We're here because they're consumers looking for quality.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it turned it into the media side, because the moderator asked me, like, what does the community need to do? And I said, it largely starts with the media.
Mm-hmm.
One of our food magazine writers is from Cleveland, and her and I were talking a couple years ago about, in Cleveland, the chef scene. It's, you know, Jonathan Sawyer and Michael Simon are Cleveland guys, right? And she's like, Bill, you can go to Cleveland and ask a diner that's somewhat of a regular person on going out and knowing all the restaurants, and they can name five chefs that aren't Michael Simon or Jonathan Sawyer. We don't have that here yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the evolution that I'm really pushing, really proud to be a part of. Certainly haven't given up on in any way, and I really believe that we're cresting into this place that is nationally legitimate. And when the email came last summer about being invited to cook in New York, it was like I've immediately turned it into less about me and more about Columbus. And I invited a brewer, a distiller, farmer to come with me to be in the room in New York and point to him and be like, there's the guy that raised the chicken and the pork tonight, and this person's father-in-law owns the trout farm. He just came as a guest, you know.
So, like, you told the Columbus story, not the
exactly.
Bill Glover story.
We called it Columbus Calling. We had menus printed, and beside each dish was the story of the dish, like trout. It was like my earliest memories as a kid in PA were going trout fishing with my dad on opening day. It was like a big deal. It was like a holiday. And like, I wanted to work all these things into the menu that spoke to not only my history, but the culture in which I get to cook every day. And to be able to bring a brewer who spent grain feeds the pigs, and the distillery that does the same thing, and it's locally made spirits, locally made beer. There's only four things served that night that weren't from Ohio, and it was four wines. It is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, you want to do the best you can.
Of course, you still want to have
absolutely.
Good reviews.
Like, we're going to make this an excellent menu, but we just want to make sure we do everything we can to make sure that the food from top to bottom is from right here in Ohio.
Great.
So we prepped it, packed it. My chef de cuisine and I, I rented a Ford, giant Ford, I think, Expedition, and we drove to Manhattan. And I was able to score some space at the New York Hilton. And they gave me a big part of the kitchen to work in for 4 days leading up to the night of the event. We drove over, cooked dinner, and phenomenal. There's a great, about a 9-minute documentary on YouTube.
Okay.
It's called Columbus Calling. If you just search like Chef Bill Glover or Columbus Calling, it'll be one of the top ones.
Okay.
But it's a great representation of that night and that journey. And there's shots of me on the farm talking to the farmer about which breeds I think would work. A lot of shots of the moments while we were in the kitchen that night, speaking to the guests at the end of dinner. And explaining that to them, like, many of the people in the room tonight are why this is possible. And this is less about me and more about an entire community of food and beverage people in Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio, that are kicking ass and doing it on a level that isn't good for Ohio. It's
right.
Nationally relevant.
So what are the next steps with the regional food system?
So really what yesterday was like the first of what I do believe are going to be a series of town hall style Q&A and feedback from users. Because we want to continually develop the tool to make it relevant and make it something people want to use.
Mm-hmm.
So it's workable. And, you know, big picture, it'd be great to be able to share this with other edibles all over the country to kind of help promote this same connectivity with them.
And it's probably good to keep getting together to continue the conversation.
Yeah, and just based on the demand that came up, like we did it up here. I wanted to do it in the restaurant. So over on this side of the wine wall, we can seat about 65. And that's maxed out, you know. We really shot for 50, hopefully we can get 50, and we could have done 120.
Nice.
What I think that says is we should do more to make it available to everybody that wants to have a voice. You know, there's no better way to get full engagement than to give somebody a sense of ownership to the process.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can be here and talk about it, and say, this would help me, it empowers them to want to share it and use it and talk about it. And you know, that gets the momentum.
What's your ultimate goal? Do you want to see every chef in Columbus sourcing locally?
It's realistic to a point. I mean,
just the driving force behind.
Yeah, I think that any restaurant, like, this menu is not 100% Ohio because we don't have shrimp, we don't have tuna, we don't have fish ribs from Brazil. But regionally, that's not possible. But at the same time, my hero is Thomas Keller at French Laundry up in Napa. He buys all his butter from Vermont because it's the best butter in the country. And he gets flack for it. This is a 3-star guy that's been, like, the hero of so many. And, like, scores of talented chefs have come and gone through his kitchen that are the current leading inspiration for American dining. And he doesn't make any excuses. He's like, look, if somebody in California or in my region makes better butter, I would love to see it. Until then, I'm going to buy it from there. If I want good parm, I'm going to get it from Reggiano, like Parmesan Reggiano. That's the best parm. I'm not going to make like this banner statement that we're only local, because it's not sustainable either. Mm-hmm. We have seasons. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't count on apples in February. They're not going to be right. And I'm not going to get some cardboard apple that it's not appropriate for the time. There are things that have to be considered to be realistic. And a lot of the livestock from here is, there are no seasons in that regard. But like, when we look at the plant-based food, we have to be selective on who we buy from locally. There are a few like hydroponic greenhouses that are all year long where we get a lot of our lettuce from. The Chef's Garden in Milan, Ohio, or Upper Sandusky, Huron, there's that little area up there. They have a lot of greenhouses, so we buy a ton of veg from them, and it's world class. So, like, there are ways that you can work around our winter and remain local. But to say, like, it's possible to do a menu that's a la Alice Waters or every single thing, it's not possible.
Right.
So I don't make any illusions of that. And I think that's something that is unfortunately often the case, not only here. It's an epidemic that people want to, like, advertise, oh, this is local, well, where is it from? You have to go further. Mm-hmm. Like, ask where. That's why we are big on the storytelling and saying, like, this is the best way to engage a guest and to create an experience. It's something you're going to think about tomorrow on the plane or at your desk, or, hey, this is a cool thing that happened last night.
Yeah. You know? Well, thank you for telling us your story.
Cheers.
It's been great chatting with you and learning more about Columbus, and
right on.
Now we get to eat.
You've been listening to Associate Producer Laura Kaler reporting from Columbus, Ohio, where she's been visiting with the Executive Chef Bill Glover at the Hilton Columbus Downtown's Gallery Bar and Bistro.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting from Knoxville, Tennessee. Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada. Kim Schneider from Michigan. Elaine Masters in San Diego. Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon. Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas. And Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
Se asoman y se admiran, se asoman las muchachas a la margarita.